Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, May 29th, 2019, and this is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, May 29th, 2019. Ahead this hour, the latest on flooding in the Arkansas River Valley. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek lets us know what city and state officials know about the immediate future and what engineers are considering about infrastructure after the water recedes. After our show today on NPR's Here and Now, as Florida prepares to let teachers carry guns to school next fall, a Parkland teacher says he doesn't want to. The second of our two conversations about teachers carrying guns at school. Plus the day's news and more on Here and Now at 1, right after Ozarks at Large on 91.3. And by the way, the flooding in the Fort Smith region means today's appointments and business at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service office in Fort Smith will not take place. The office closed at noon yesterday and remains closed today. People with appointments will receive notifications for new dates and times. More information available at uscis.gov or at the office's homes on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. The Army Corps of Engineers says the Arkansas River at Fort Smith and Van Buren crested this morning at just below 41 feet after several days of flooding. That's about a foot and a half lower than earlier estimates, but still 20 feet above flood stage, breaking a previous record of 38 feet. According to the city of Fort Smith, the water has damaged nearly 1,000 structures. More than 600 of those structures are homes. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek went to Fort Smith yesterday, where residents are under a flash flood watch until tomorrow morning.
That's the sound of the Arkansas River rushing under the Garrison Avenue Bridge between Fort Smith and Oklahoma. The bridge has been closed to traffic for several days, but pedestrians have been allowed to walk across it to see the historic flooding for themselves. Meanwhile, just a few blocks down from the riverfront, volunteers are filling sandbags and hauling them to the side of the road for residents who are doing what they can to protect their properties from flooding.
I got it. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In the same parking lot, another group of volunteers is busy cooking and packaging food that's going to be delivered to several feeding centers across the city.
And it's difficult to say what that recovery period is going to look like.
That's Fort Smith Mayor George McGill.
But what we are in control of is how we respond. And if we respond in an exceptional way in this crisis, those are the things that would define our community for decades.
And McGill says they're already putting services in place for when the river starts receding in the next few days.
We have a great team. We've come together to try to make this thing as painless as possible. We have the boots on the ground. And so, we want to make sure that our citizens are informed and that we are directing them in the right directions to get the service and meet the needs that they may have during this crisis.
McGill says a multi-agency center will be set up in the Sears building at Central Mall, where residents will be able to get assistance as they begin to clean up and rebuild.
Our emergency services are going to be protecting your property against possible looting or things like that. But I would certainly contact your insurance company and file a claim, whether you have flood insurance or not.
Stan Snodgrass, Fort Smith's director of engineering, says his department is also monitoring the levee to make sure it's protecting the city from further flooding.
We've been working with the Corps of Engineers. They've came up, they've driven them, we're inspecting them multiple times a day and at night.
The levee starts under the Garrison Avenue Bridge and extends 5 miles north along Riverfront Drive.
They're being tested to their max, so obviously we need to try to, you know, keep track on, particularly on the one where the walking trail is. It's got a lot of water pressure that's pushing against that, so we need to keep an eye on it, for probably a couple of weeks till the water starts receding.
Snodgrass says so far the levee is fine, but engineers are keeping an eye out for any signs of weakness.
Well, they're looking to see, if you've got any areas that are sloughing, any areas that water's coming through. any areas that potentially waterside that could be, being washed out along the edges, just that kind of stuff, any movement, depression, that type of stuff. So.
Snodgrass adds their other concern is the rain that's been predicted for Fort Smith today.
Obviously, if we get very, very heavy rains, then we're not going to be able to keep up, and it's going to cause backup in the areas that are current. There are areas that are inside the levee that are currently not flooding. If you're in a flood zone and you've not flooded with the impeding rain, you just, be alert, pay attention. A lot can happen real quick when the systems are already full.
For those who haven't been affected by the flooding and are looking to help, Mitzi Little, the marketing director for the United Way of Fort Smith area, says the organization is coordinating the volunteer effort.
We have a registration page on our website that they can go to and register. At this point, the volunteer opportunities are limited because we're still at the beginning of this. This is going to be a long-term, deal, basically. And we're going to need volunteers for a long time.
Little says the United Way is working to set up a volunteer intake center in the coming days. But in the meantime, they are taking monetary donations, which can be made by texting FLOOD 2019 to 91999.
And all of the proceeds that come in from those donations are going to go out 100% to the agencies and they're helping with the victims of the floods. United Way will not have any overhead. We don't have any overhead anyway at this United Way. We're blessed with an endowment that takes care of all of that. So 100% of any donation that is given to this number, FLOOD 2019, is going to go to flood victim assistance.
Little, who spoke with us at the Fort Smith Convention Center, says right now the organization is focusing on making sure displaced residents have places to get food.
Trent Goins and OK Food are across the street from us right now cooking, and that's going out to different food stations. We have volunteers that are helping with that.
One of those feeding stations can be found at the Grand Avenue Baptist Church, where Don Lehman is the executive pastor.
Anybody that's affected in the area can come to Grand Avenue Baptist Church and get a hot meal. We'll be serving lunch at noon and dinner at 6 p.m. Every day through at least this coming Sunday. Anybody, victims and volunteers, are all welcome to come for a hot meal.
The church is located down the road from several streets that have been barricaded to keep people away from the water just beyond them.
Probably about a mile and a half away, there's a creek that has backed up from the Arkansas River that's backed up into neighbors' yards and into homes. So folks fairly close by who thought they would never flood because they're so far from the river, suddenly they have water in their house.
Lehman says the church is also gearing up to help those residents once the flooding goes down.
Long term, though, what we're going to be doing now is getting ready for what we call mud out, which is cleaning out flooded houses, pulling everything out of houses, the rebuilding process that's going to take weeks and weeks.
Lehman says it'll be another week to 10 days before they'll start sending out teams of trained volunteers.
And we will train teams through the Arkansas Baptist Disaster Relief. We'll train teams that go in, and they're trained to clean, to kill mold, to safely dispose of stuff that's been flooded, to kind of prevent disease, things like that. So we'll train teams that will go in and start helping people get their lives back together.
Mayor George McGill says if there's a silver lining to the flooding, it's the way it's brought people together.
There's a grit about Fort Smith, and the people rally at the right time. It's been amazing what I've seen as I moved about, seeing people come together, bagging sand, feeding their neighbors, and they've done it with a spirit that's hard to explain.
And McGill says they're ready to deal with whatever they find after the Arkansas River settles back into its banks.
Floods leave massive damage. And so what we want to do is stay the course, and we don't want to become complacent in the things that we know we need to do. And we'll work real hard not to get tired. And I think at the end of the day, Fort Smith will be much stronger than she's ever been.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzanna Sitek.
The Arkansas Highway Department briefly closed the I-540 and Midland bridges between Fort Smith and Van Buren Monday night. Those reopened yesterday after it was determined the bridges are fine. The threat of flooding now moves downstream. The water has already topped levees in Logan and Perry counties. Governor Asa Hutchinson declared a state of emergency earlier this week. And yesterday, President Trump tweeted that FEMA and the federal government will do whatever is necessary to help out with what has turned out to be record flooding.
Walton Arts Center presents the 10th annual Artisphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival, June 10th through the 29th, featuring dozens of events, including the Artisphere Festival Orchestra and Chapel Music Series, along with Trail Mix, a space-themed film series, and more. ArtisphereFestival.org for tickets and for the full festival event lineup. 91.3 is supported by Butterfield Trail Village, a premier Northwest Arkansas retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being. Offering a variety of amenities and living options from apartments to village homes, plus on-site fitness facilities. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org for more. Additional support provided by Death Ray Illustration and Print Expo, Saturday, June 29th at the Hilton Garden Inn in Fayetteville. This event is a multifaceted experience featuring art, entertainment, aspiration, and education of visual storytelling. Go CaddyWampus.com for tickets and information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Two University of Arkansas professors have found placing imperceptible barcodes on products may prevent injuries among cashiers and lead to more retail efficiency. Imperceptible barcodes are not visible to the human eye, but they're placed all over the packaging, so a product is scannable from any side. Molly Jensen, a clinical associate professor of marketing in the Sam M. Walton College of Business, and Caitlin Gallagher, an assistant professor of exercise science in the College of Education and Health Professions, began collaborating on the research project in 2016. Jensen first started conducting barcode research in the McMillan Innovation Studio on the U of A campus. Research moved to the Exercise Research Center when she needed access to equipment for measuring human performance. Yesterday, Professor Jensen came to Studio 123 to discuss the research with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda.
We mocked up, we went out and measured what a cash register setup should be in terms of height. Digimarc, one of the companies that does this, really I think probably the main company doing this technology, graciously gave us a scanner. And the scanner is able to switch between reading the imperceptible barcodes and reading traditional. So we didn't need two pieces of equipment. They helped with a lot of product. And then the Center for Retail Excellence, which is one of the centers at the Walton College of Business, gave us a small grant to help buy product. And then actually the company funded us with a modest $25,000 grant to run the research. And then they were great. You know, they just stepped out of it and said, can we have the data when we're done? And we said, sure, after we get published, well, you can have, you know.
How did you actually run the experiment? Did you just have volunteers or did you have actual cashiers? And what exactly were you measuring, like the injury to their wrist, the injury to their back?
So we measured muscle activity and skeletal activity with two different sets of sensors. So the best way to describe it is to think about when they take someone like LeBron James, and you can, there are pictures all over the internet, and you see they have all the little sensors all over them,
the
and then
like
they say
green balls or something.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And then they say play basketball, and then they digitize it so that when you play a game, it looks exactly like his physical idiosyncratic movements, right? So these one set of sensors we use are little tiny disco balls. They have, I don't even know how many mirrors on them, thousands. They're about the size of a pea. And we would connect them to the arms, the upper back, the shoulders, and the chest of the participants. And then we had another set of sensors that measured muscle activity, that actually measured the, like an EEG, like when you have a heart measurement that measures actually the signal sent through the muscles.
Okay.
Okay. So with the sensors that had the little disco balls, and Dr. Gallagher's going to be upset because I don't know all the technical names, but there were cameras, like eight cameras in this little room all around the ceiling so that it would pick up every movement. And so it was a reflection from those little disco balls, right? So that's how the camera picked it up. We wanted professional cashiers because most people don't realize how difficult cashiering is and that it's truly an art. And it is not a job you can just step into and be good at. It's a job you can certainly step into and just do, but you can't just step into it and be good at it. And so we use three types of packaging. We use traditional UPC. So when you look at a box and you see the one little triangle that's about 1 inch by 2 inch that has the little black lines, that's the UPC. Most traditional packages have one UPC. And so if you can imagine, when that gets on the scanner, the cashier has to find it. And then one of the innovations in cash register and UPC reading was the two-sided reader, which we take for granted. But if you go self-check at any grocery store or at Whole Foods or whatever, you'll see that there's like a – it looks red. There's one on the bottom and one on the side. So you have two shots out of six to get the UPC on a traditional package, right? So that was actually an innovation that came about maybe 30 years ago that kind of revolutionized UPC technology. And then this is kind of the next big one, so in probably even bigger. Then we did – there are some grocery stores primarily out of Europe. So, for example, Aldi is one, which is a German-owned company, where they have – if you have a six-sided box – they have UPCs on five of the six sides. So it's not as aesthetically pleasing to the consumer, but it's super easy for the cashier because with two places to read the UPC, the vertical and the horizontal, it doesn't matter what side the cashier slides, one of those two sensors will pick up the signal. So that makes it easier for the cashier. They don't have to lift heavy things. Then there's the imperceptible UPC, which is the one we used was made by Digimart, where they don't even have to look at all. They just slide. And so we hypothesized that those two might function the same, but they might not. So we realized quickly that we didn't want amateur cashiers, back to your original question, because it's an art, and it's not easy. And so we recruited cashiers who had worked a minimum of 1,000 hours, which is a part-time job, over the last 12 months. And basically, we got full-time cashiers. And I put it out on social media. I put it out to friends. But basically, what we did is I just walked up to people and said, I'm doing this study. You can earn some money.
So at the store, you were just like, hey.
Yeah, hey. you can. And we made some flyers. You
oh,
know.
How fun. Okay.
So I went to ONF, which is Ozark Natural Food, went to some Walmarts around town, went to Harb's, went to Aldi's. So we wanted a variety. We had enough money, I think, for initially 12, and then we found a little bit more money, and we got up to 17 cashiers. And then we just did a variety of comparisons. So with the imperceptible barcode, even though it was imperceptible because it's not a technology that's available everywhere, all of those packages also have a single traditional barcode, right? So we could turn the machine on to just read the imperceptible barcode, and then we could flip a switch, and the subjects had to do it with just the one traditional barcode. So that was a super clean comparison. With the multi-sided barcode, we basically had to mock up because they don't have identical items. So we might have had a bottle of olive oil in the imperceptible and traditional. So we got another bottle of oil from the company that had multi-sided, and we would buy two. One we would leave multi-sided, and one we would take black tape and cover it up so there was just a traditional UPC left. Does that make sense? And so those were kind of the two main comparisons.
So what did you find?
Well, so it was really interesting. We found essentially that, of course, with traditional, so one UPC code on a box, versus imperceptible, they were different. And we found that traditional versus multi-sided were different. But initially, we found that the multi-sided versus imperceptible were the same. And so, and when I say the same, I mean in terms of body movement and, you know, we didn't really measure injury. Mm-hmm. We just measured potentiality, right? So these are the kinds of things that we know that could lead to, right? So it's because you can't, it's not causal at this point. So we started thinking about, well, this is not really how a cashier works. I mean, all in all, they may be scanned for 30 minutes out of 2 hours. There's so much hubbub that went on getting them ready and, you know, moving product and stuff. And so we started discussing, well, what would it look like over a four-hour shift? So we went back to some of our cashiers and said, you know, how long do you work without a break? How much time? And they're like, well, usually, you know, the max would be 4 hours. Usually it's less than that, but the max would be 4 hours. And again, different companies have different policies, worker policies, that kind of thing. You know, at Aldi, they sit. Mm-hmm. Walmart, some of the other chains, they don't sit. So just lots of differences. So when we extrapolated the differences are the muscle movements and the skeletal movements out over time to what would be a potential four-hour shift, we found that the imperceptible barcode would lead to less injury potentiality. And that the multi-sided began to look a little bit more like traditional. But, as in with most research, there's a lot of buts, you know, it matters on the size of the package and what you're doing. And if someone comes up with 50 bottles of juice that are, you know, a half gallon each, it doesn't matter whether you have five-sided, one UPC, a wrapped UPC, imperceptible. You still have to pick it up, you know? So there's all kinds of confounding factors that would be great to think about next. Like, what are the next steps to this?
How important is this type of research to stores? From the consumer's end, they may think, well, sure, this saves the cashier a couple of seconds, or this reduces their risk of injury just by this little bit.
Sure.
Does that really matter? But I assume from a store's perspective, a company's perspective, that's something that they care about quite a bit.
Yeah, so absolutely. So they're, you know, a grocery store is going to look at the ROI, which is return on investment. And so how profitable is it? And, you know, again, like a lot of things that seem like such a simple everyday task, this cashiering has, you know, it's multifaceted. So one of the things you're looking at is time. So the busier the cashier, the faster they can scan, the more consumers they can get through the line. So that's profit for the company. The less cashiers they might have to employ during a given time. I mean, how many times do you go to a store and there are 4 to 15 human-man cashier stations, humaned cashier stations, and no people there? There's like two open, right? So if the consumer can get through more quickly and they can hire less people, so there's another place for profit, right? Additionally, think about all the kinds of things that you get from lost labor. So there's a whole nother set of costs that are involved with paying somebody because they called in sick. If the injury occurs during work, then reasonably so, the company is then should be on the hook for those injuries and should then therefore pay for those. So that's, again, a decrease in profit. And so if this kind of technology can decrease injury potentiality, you know, some actuarial, someone smarter than me who could run those numbers and put everything into a model and look at, like, what people were being paid and how many days would we gain by them not being injured, you know, they could easily find out what the profit would be.
Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, I appreciate your interest, and I really appreciate you asking us to come down.
Molly Jensen is a clinical associate professor of marketing at the University of Arkansas. She spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda at the Carver Center for Public Radio yesterday. Her research is published in the International Journal of Industrial Ergonomics. You can find a link to the study on our website, ozarksatlarge.com. The first Pacific Islander Youth Summit was held late yesterday afternoon in Springdale at Harbor High School in association with the annual Marshallese Education Day Award Ceremony. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich was there. She brings us this report.
The Pacific Islander Youth Summit, called Navigating Success, drew several hundred Marshallese grandparents, parents, siblings, and students because it was blended with the annual Marshallese Education Day Award Ceremony. After a short welcome, summit participants were entertained with live Islander electronica. Before the summit, Melissa Leyline, Chief Executive Director of Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese, described the merged event.
Instead of focusing on Education Day, which is very common, something that we do back home, is we honor students that are 3.0 GPA and above. But this time is a little different. We do that, and also we have breakout sessions. Breakout session on topics like climate change and also higher education. And also we do have a session particularly for parent, basic giving education on budgeting, credit report, how important that is, and what to do when you purchase a car. And, you know, we don't want to leave out the juvenile system as well. We need to get them included in there, so they're going to be here talking about what they're seeing in the juvenile system and, you know, how parents can be more involved.
The mission of this summit is to inspire Pacific Islander youth to aspire towards growth through leadership, education, cultural integrity, and commitment to community. Pacific Islander Youth Summit spokesperson Myra Andrew is only among a handful of Marshallese currently enrolled at the University of Arkansas.
It's not that much talked about in, like, the Marshallese community or in our culture, since we're, like, very family-based. And so I guess that's one of, like, the elements for this youth summit, to promote higher education and everything around or outside of our culture.
High school senior Kajo Jordan is a member of the Marshallese Youth Organization, a roving musical group who perform at Islander functions. He says the summit is a good place to network.
Well, it's honestly important because, like, you know, we are combining and learning our own culture and how it is and how it goes, the manners and everything. So it's very important to us youth and, yeah, little younglings and others.
The keynote address was delivered by Lillian Mara Sherrill, a 2018 University of Central Arkansas graduate.
So basically what I'm going to speak up to the students is about what was it like, you know, being raised by immigrant parents from Marshall Islands and the struggles that I went through, not only financially, but also, like, socially as well. And I'm just going to show them that, you know, anyone can be anything that they want to be. It doesn't matter what title you are, what race you are. Like, if you have that mindset, you can be successful if you really want it. And so I just want to showcase that, like, if I can do it, anyone can do it too.
The Pacific Islander Youth Summit is a collaboration of Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese, the Republic of the Marshall Islands Consulate in Springdale, and the Marshallese College Student Association. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And still to come this hour on Ozarks, our usual rundown of musical opportunities from Fort Smith to Bentonville, and why watching a cat helps Dan Hoy when he's on stage this week at Walton Arts Center. Stay tuned.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum, presenting Live at the Five and Dime concert series each Wednesday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. This series, in collaboration with the University of Arkansas Department of Music and Downtown Bentonville Incorporated, is located on the square in downtown Bentonville. WalmartMuseum.com under Events tab for more information. Additional support for KUAF comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, now featuring technology and telecoms, plus local business news from Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions and information available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com.
Ozark Folkways in Winslow is offering a mountain music workshop for beginners Saturday from 11 to 5. You can bring a folk instrument of your choice, learn to play and sing well-known old-time classics. It's all taking place in an encouraging atmosphere. If you'd like more information, ozarkfolkways.org.
This is Reflections in Black, and I'm your host, Raven Cook. Reflections in Black is a segment dedicated to exploring the legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. Reflections in Black also provides resources for understanding and hope for all people. William Harold Flowers was born in Stamps, Arkansas, also known as Lafayette County, in 1911. The son of a businessman and school teacher, Flowers was the eldest of three boys. In 1927, while on a trip with his father to Little Rock, Arkansas, he witnessed the lynching of John Carter. The incident propelled Flowers into a life of fighting for racial justice and civil rights. Flowers would go on to attend the Robert Terrell School of Law in Washington, D.C., and return to Arkansas to pass the bar exam in 1935. During the 1940s, Flowers established the Committee on Negro Organizations in Stamps on March 10, 1940, in an effort to mobilize voter registration throughout the state. Through Flowers' efforts, Arkansas Black voter participation rose from 1.5% in 1940 to 17.3% in 1947. In 1945, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, also known as the NAACP, set up an Arkansas state branch, and Flowers was appointed as chief recruitment officer. In 1947, Attorney Flowers successfully defended two brothers accused of killing two white men. Both brothers' death sentences were commuted, a huge victory for Flowers, whose efforts to ensure representation on the jury saved the lives of the men. Flowers would also become a voice in school desegregation efforts in Arkansas, acting as counsel to Silas H. Hunt, who would go on to be known for integrating the University of Arkansas School of Law in 1948. Additionally, in 1948, Flowers would be elected president of the Arkansas state branches of the NAACP. Continuing his legal push for equality and equity in education, Flowers worked in DeWitt County to make sure that school facilities were equal, contributing to the foundation for the landmark 1954 case Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. Serving as president of the African American National Bar Association in 1953, Flowers would go on to additionally become an ordained minister in the United Methodist Church in 1971. He also would become the first Black Special Circuit Court judge in Jefferson County in 1977. Continuing his life of service, in 1980, Flowers would become an associate justice in the State Court of Appeals, appointed by then-Governor Bill Clinton. In 1981, the Arkansas Black Lawyers Association renamed itself after the Arkansas legend, now known as the W. Harold Flowers Law Society. W. Harold Flowers' life of service would end on April 7, 1990. But his example and his commitment to the betterment of our state for all people is a legacy that we should each strive to uphold every day. Today, we honor the incredible life and legacy of an Arkansas hero, attorney W. Harold Flowers.
Reflections in Black is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You can hear weekly segments on Ozarks at Large, and you can learn more about this series by searching KUAF.com for Reflections in Black.
It's Wednesday, the final Wednesday of May. Let's get an update on the great live music we can see in the next few days through the weekend with Timothy Dennis. Timothy, good to be back. How are you doing?
I'm good. Welcome back.
Thank you.
This weekend, we have a lot of music to choose from.
All right.
Let's start with Thursday night. George's Majestic Lounge is going to have a bill with all local bands. starting with the jazzy psychedelic rock of Monk is King.
Okay.
And then other forms of rock with Jed Harrelson and The Juice.
So three
bands.
Three artists on one bill.
Cover for that show is $8. Set to get on our way at 9 o'clock. Again, that's Thursday night at George's in Fayetteville. Still in Fayetteville Thursday night, Backspace is going to have a show featuring the Minnesota band Lavender Daughter. They call themselves Dark Surf, Grunge, and Rock and Roll.
All right. I like it. A surf band from Minnesota.
They are joined on that bill by local rockers May the Peace of the Sea Be With You and Mindless Souls.
All at Backspace.
That has a $5 suggested donation at the door, set to get our way at 8 o'clock. Again, that is Thursday night. Moving on to Friday, there are a couple of festivals happening this weekend. Starting in Eureka Springs, it's the annual Rhythm and Blues Weekend.
Mm-hmm.
This year is going to feature sets in Basin Spring Park from Tony Redmond, Jeremiah Johnson, Rich McDonough, and Brick Fields. Okay. But there's also stuff happening at Chelsea's and elsewhere throughout Eureka Springs.
Is there one place where you can find out more?
There is. You can look it up on Facebook. We'll have a link at our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
Sounds good.
Those shows in Basin Spring Park are actually free. Friday, they'll get underway at 3 p.m., Saturday at 2 p.m.
All right.
Another festival happening this weekend is Backwoods Music Festival down at Mulberry Mountain. That festival is going to feature Umphrey's McGee, Yonder Mountain String Band, Keller Williams, the infamous String Dusters, and many, many more. Tickets for that festival start at $130 for Sunday general admission. They run all the way up to about $350 for weekend VIP tickets. And it runs from Friday through Sunday.
Sunday night, right?
Yes.
They go through Sunday night.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is all taking place at Mulberry Mountain outside of Ozark. Moving on to other shows happening Friday night, Route 358 will be at Kingfish in Fayetteville.
Outdoor stage, great time of year.
Perfect for a local folk family band.
Mm-hmm.
That show at Kingfish gets underway at 9 o'clock Friday night. One more show in Fayetteville Friday night. State House Electric will be at Dixon Street Pub.
Tonight my heart is sad, lonely for the only one I love.
They're normally a duo playing kind of old-timey, folky music, but this show they're going to be featuring bassist Rob Butler performing with them.
Okay.
If you can't catch them Friday night, they're also playing at the Gravel Bar in Eureka Springs Saturday at 7 p.m.
Or you could catch them both times.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The show Friday night at Dixon Street Pub also gets underway at 7 o'clock. Also happening Friday night, but up the road in Springdale, Black Apple Crossing is going to have Becky Adams.
Mm-hmm.
The one you see when the lights fade, when the lights fade. I wanna be the only one that takes you out, babe. Takes you out, babe, here.
She was on our show a few weeks ago. She's a great singer and songwriter from Northwest Arkansas. That show at Black Apple Crossing gets underway at 8 o'clock Friday night. Also happening Friday night, but down in Fort Smith, Temple Live is going to have Cody Canada and The Departed.
Probably would just suggest you call to make sure
yes.
anything in Fort Smith is still happening
yes,
after
definitely.
The rains and floods. Right.
Definitely. If it is still happening, though, that show will have $25 general admission, $30 if you want to be in the pit. Tickets increase by $5 the day of. And if it is still happening, that will take place at 8 p.m. Friday night at Temple Live in Fort Smith.
And you can check Temple Live's Facebook page or webpage. They stay on top of what's happening there.
Right. Moving on to Saturday night, Smoke and Barrel Tavern is going to have Bray, Lenny, and the Blackout.
I love the name. I do not know Bray, Lenny, and the Blackout.
It is a Little Rock-based band. They do kind of modern soul and R&B.
Oh, all right.
Seen a woman in need of love. But the world's too tough to give her love. Seen a baby on 9 o'clock news. Everybody's got the blues.
That show has a $5 cover. It'll get underway at 10 o'clock Saturday night. Again, that's at Smoke and Barrel in Fayetteville. Also happening in downtown Fayetteville Saturday night, the Hill Raisers will be at Weston Watson. They're kind of a non-traditional bluegrass band from Northwest Arkansas. Still play stringed instruments,
yep,
though.
Yep, yep.
That show at Weston Watson gets underway at 8 o'clock Saturday night. Moving on, Crystal Bridges is going to kick off the summer concert series in the Forest.
Which should be pretty amazing.
It should be. This week, they are going to feature the band Yarn, which is a New York-based, North Carolina-raised Americana and alt-country band.
Mm-hmm. To my Carolina heart. Need a new path to walk along. One that won't make me lost. I need a new flat to rest my head.
They have smooth as butter harmonies. Hmm. They are incredible. The Vine Brothers will open that show. Tickets are $12, $10 if you're a member, and it's free for youth under 18.
And we're going to hear the Vine Brothers, great friends of the show, coming into the Furman Garner Performance Studio this week.
And if you can't catch either of those performances, they will also be at Fayetteville Public Library Sunday at 2 as part of Mountain Street Stage Series.
And that's absolutely free.
Absolutely.
All right.
That show at Crystal Bridges starts at 7 o'clock Saturday night. Now, moving back over to Eureka Springs, Earl and them will be at Chelsea's.
Earl, as in Earl, Kate, and a lot of friends.
Hence the them.
Yes.
That is part of the whole blues weekend, sure, that's going on over in Eureka Springs. That show at Chelsea's is set to get underway at 6 o'clock Saturday evening. Now, another Fort Smith show that you'll want to double check that's still going on, Harry's Downtown is going to have Ben Miller Band.
They're fun.
Night at the beach, hoping in vain that you turn and look at me.
That, again, will be at Harry's Downtown. Tickets are $10 in advance, $15 day of, set to get underway at 9 o'clock Saturday night. Also happening Saturday night, up the road in Bentonville, the House of Songs will have their monthly songwriter showcase at Bike Rack Brewing Company. This month, they're going to feature Joe Dillstrom, who's a folk singer from Springfield, the Cosmic Farmers, Emily Rowland, and Justin Larkin.
And this is a listening room atmosphere.
It is
you
a
go
listening
in.
Room atmosphere. It's in the brew room, mm-hmm, so it's kind of a brew room session type deal. Tickets for that show are $10. It'll get underway at 8 o'clock Saturday night. Again, that's Bike Rack Brewing Company in Bentonville. Now, finally, Sunday afternoon, Buffalo Gals will be at Brews in Eureka Springs.
Buffalo Gals with a Eureka Springs connection, of course.
Exactly. Melissa Carper, right, and Rebecca Paddock. Fantastic folk songs with beautiful harmonies. If you get sick of blues throughout the weekend, here's your antidote to that at the end of it.
All right.
And there you go.
You're right. Plenty of music. Timothy Dennis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I don't have a honey, so I can't lose my heart. I can't lose what I don't have, and I can't lose my mind, 'cause I already lost it, and I can't remember where I last saw.
The venerable musical Cats is back on stage at Walton Arts Center for the first time in a dozen years. It opened last night and stays in town until Sunday afternoon. This morning, Dan Hoy, who is the feline Monk's Trap in this national touring performance, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. He says, as a child, he played a VHS copy of the West End production of Cats so many times, his family's VCR broke. He says that, however, did not make his audition for the production any easier.
It was honestly kind of the opposite thought initially for me. So I dance, I do, I move a lot, but I would not say that I am a dancer first. I'm definitely a singer-actor. And I remember getting the call and thinking, okay, I'm going to go in, we're going to, because I obviously I know the piece, we're going to use that to sort of inform the choices and we'll see what happens. And I actually, I have a funny story with the woman who's now playing Grisabella, Carrie Renee Fuller. She and I actually went to school together for a brief amount of time. And she and I had done a show together. And I remember we saw each other at the callbacks and the final callbacks. And when we saw each other, we're like, this is crazy. Like, we're not going to be in the show. We never in a million years thought that we would be in Cats. And lo and behold, here we are. So it was a really fun process. I remember the creative team being very, very willing to play around with choices, and they were really interested in the acting of the piece, which is something I don't think is discussed enough with Cats. Because I think one of its biggest criticisms is usually, well, there's not so much of a plot. And it is true. I mean, there is a through line, there is a plot, but it is a lot. It's poetry. Mm-hmm. So it's based on T.S. Eliot's Book of Practical Cats. And it does have a through line. And what's beautiful with what the creative team has done is you couldn't get away with having anything that wasn't informed, anything that wasn't given its full weight in terms of acting choices. And that was one of the most fun things about the audition process, was getting to play with those different choices.
What is the process like from when you get to the venue until you're on stage?
Load-in days are insane. So usually on Tuesdays, sometimes Wednesdays, depending on what the schedule is. I usually get to the theater on load-in days 3 hours before curtain, because we have to do, we have a company meeting, we have sound check, we have these various things that we have to do on our first day there. So for example, yesterday we had a 7 o'clock show. I got to the theater at 4 o'clock, spent the first hour doing makeup. Then at that, like 4:45, 5 o'clock, somewhere in there, they called for company meeting. We all get together. They discuss, you know, this is what this theater is like. This is what the spacing is going to be like in the house, because there are a lot of moments where the cats spread out through the audience and sort of have those interactions. Discuss backstage things, discuss how the previous week went. And then we break for sound check, where we all get on stage and just sing a few numbers to make sure that the balance is okay. And then we go into lift call, which is where we make sure all of the lifts in the show are working, because there are a lot in this production. Then after that, it's warming up for a little bit. Then you have wig calls, and then you get into costume, and then you go. So it's like, it's definitely a hectic few hours before this production.
And what about the process after final curtain, after the encore?
It's scraping makeup off your face. That is what a fair amount of it is. We have, so, you know, you get off stage, you take the glue off of the sides of your face, take the wig off, you get back upstairs, you scrub your face down, you get the costume off. And then you pack up and you go do rope line out back at the stage door.
Rope line. I'm sorry.
Sorry. That's always what I've called it. But usually that's just like the time where the audience members who have gone out to the stage door back behind the theater can then meet cast members as they're coming out, get autographs, have a quick conversation. I don't know where I picked up rope line, but because it's typically in New York, you have like a little barrier between. But it's really, that's probably one of my favorite moments after each production, is getting to actually meet audience members and discuss, you know, what their thoughts. And for a lot of people, this production holds a lot of value. So it's a really special moment to have those interactions.
Do you look at cats, I mean, the real cats, felines, those four-legged animals, any differently now that you've been in this?
This is something that everyone always, I tell this to people and they think I'm insane, but it's true. We did a lot of animal study with actual cats. Because one of the big things that, especially a woman named Chrissy Cartwright, who has actually been with cats since the 80s, she was the associate of Gillian Lynn, who was the original choreographer of that original production. She would talk about this all the time, the felinity of the movement. Sure, you know, you're doing choreography, sure, you're doing blocking, and yes, of course, we're human beings, but what makes cats truly special is the time and energy put into actually moving like cats. And it was something that audience members talk about all the time, and one of the things that I know I loved when I was watching it in its original iteration in that VHS tape, yes, you have the big choreography happening in the front, but it's always fun to kind of look in at the people in the back and see how they're, even in the moments where they're breathing and off to the side, how they're moving and interacting. So now anytime I see a cat, it's interesting, because I'm like, I know where I've picked up a lot of that movement, whether it's the sharper instinctual movement or the more slinky, subdued, almost like stalking through space. It's a really fun thing to do now.
Dan Hoy is Monkstrap in the touring production of Cats at Walton Arts Center through Sunday afternoon. He visited us this morning at the Carver Center for Public Radio.
Walton Arts Center presents the 10th annual Artisphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival, June 10th through the 29th. This year, featuring performances inspired by the wonders of the universe and the beauty of our home planet, including the Artisphere Festival Orchestra, a space-themed film series, and more. Tickets and event lineup at artisphere.org. Apple Seeds is hosting its annual Picnic on the Farm, Saturday, June 1st, from 4 until 7 p.m. at the Apple Seeds Teaching Farm at Gully Park in Fayetteville. This family-friendly picnic will include live music and games. Local food and drinks will be available for purchase. AppleSeedsNWA.org for more information.
Contributors to this Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large include Susanna Sitek, Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, and Timothy Dennis. Reflections in Black is written and hosted by Raven Cook and produced by Lee Wood at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Don't forget, you can hear more news and information about our region every morning at 5:30 and 7:30 Inside Morning Edition with Antoinette Grajeda's newscast. Big thanks to Antoinette Grajeda for sitting here for most of the last week and a half. I do appreciate all the help from her and everyone else that works on Ozarks at Large. A listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Van Buren. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Always great to get a vacation. Always great to be back. Thanks for listening. We will end this Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large with music from Fetz Folly. They're going to be at a couple of places over the next 48 hours or so. They'll be at Mojo's Pints and Pies tomorrow night, beginning at 7 in Fayetteville. Then Friday night, they'll be at JJ's Grill in Bella Vista. That, too, scheduled to start at 7. You can learn much more about the band at FetzFolly.com, FetzFolly.com. We'll end with a song they recorded exclusively for Ozarks at Large at KUAF. The song is titled Getting Home. Thanks so much for listening. Back with a new show tomorrow.
Sweet baby, don't you let those teardrops fall. I'm coming home real soon. It's been so long since I have held you in my arms, and it's got me feeling blue. It's been 8 hard weeks on a long and lonely road, hurting in my heels, aching in my soul. Not sure how I'll make it through. This much is true. Girl, I best be getting home to you. Dreaming of your pretty face, need the moonlit summer sky. And if I had my way, I would run away right now and be with you tonight. It's been 8 hard weeks on a long and lonely road, hurting in my heels, aching in my soul. Not sure how I'll make it through. This much is true. Girl, I best be getting home to you. On a long and lonely road, hurting in my heels, aching in my soul. Not sure how I'll make it through. This much is true. Girl, I best be getting home.